Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and get an assessment of how President Obama's nominee to head up the Department of Defense equipped himself under a barrage of hostile questions from his former Republican Senate colleagues. Winslow Wheeler, who worked on national security issues for over 30 years for members of the U.S. Senate, joins us to discuss today's lackluster performance by Chuck Hagel and whether that will embolden Republicans to filibuster his nomination. Then we'll look into whether the recent attempt by Republicans to change the Electoral College so that the losing candidate could win the presidency has fizzled or has been put on hold. Jeremiah Gourka, a former Republican who has an article at truthout.org, Shot by Their Own Men, How the Virginia Senate Inadvertently Predicts Republican Decline, joins us to discuss how successful gerrymandering by Republicans could backfire as right-wing incumbents in safe seats are forced to run against even more extreme right-wing candidates, eventually turning off moderate and conservative voters. Then finally, we examine cyber attacks aimed at the New York Times that have been blamed on Chinese hackers in apparent retaliation for negative stories the Times had run about the fabulous wealth accrued by the families of China's leaders. Gordon Chang, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, joins us to discuss who is behind these cyber attacks and the apparent insecurity China's communist leaders have about their capitalist riches. Joining us now is Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for over 30 years for members of the United States Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2010, he authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight, and is the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Winslow Wheeler.
It's great to be with you. Thank you very much for having me.
And you spent a day watching the hearings before the Senate Armed Services Committee on the nomination of Senator Chuck Hagel. What was your impression of the hearing?
It was extremely negative for all parties. It was a horribly depressing exercise in civics. Under pressure from the Republicans on the committee, Senator Hagel spent the entire day eating his own words about his thoughts about policies in the Middle East involving Israel and Iran and American politics. He was subjected to really the crudest form of lowball, crass behavior on the parts of some Republicans. Democrats, many of them, not all of them, seemed particularly interested in what he can do for them in terms of pork for their states. It was not a happy experience for me.
And the most contentious exchange seemed to happen between Senator Hagel and his old friend John McCain, who really did go after him, did he not? I mean, there was a kind of petulance to John McCain's behavior. And of course, ever since he lost to George Bush back in 2000, he's been very bitter about Bush. And then when he lost to then-Senator Obama, now President Obama, he has been extremely bitter towards Obama as well.
Right.
So this is a very bitter man, but what's the source of his anger and bitterness towards Chuck Hagel, do you think?
Well, I can't explain that, but he did seem to almost literally lose control of himself. He expressed himself as incensed that Senator Hagel didn't agree with John McCain about the surge in Iraq, and to Senator Hagel's undying shame, Senator Hagel tried to appease Senator McCain and not answer the questions and not present the view that he had until yesterday, I guess, that the surge in Iraq was not a brilliant success, which John McCain insists it was. He was almost pounding the table, McCain. I mean, it was a remarkable performance. There was another remarkable performance by Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who was incensed that Senator Hagel stated quite accurately that the so-called pro-Israel lobby is extremely aggressive on Capitol Hill and uses intimidation to convey their point of view two senators, and Lindsey Graham intimidated Senator Hagel into rejecting his own previous statement that that was a common tactic by the pro-Israel lobby. I mean, here we are, Senator Graham saying, isn't it true that intimidation is a terrible thing, and Israel never did it, or its lobby never did it, and Senator Hagel, sort of under that intimidation, was intimidated into agreeing. I mean, it was quite remarkable.
I was under the impression, Winslow Wheeler, that Hagel was a little bit, obviously he was defensive, he was walking back a lot of stuff, but he also seemed a little muddled at times, particularly over when he mentioned the policy of containment vis-a-vis Iran, and then somebody slipped him a note, and then he sort of had to change that. And then I think it was Senator Levin sort of had to correct him and say what the correct policy of the Obama administration was towards Iran. It's not containment. Well, what is the...
Right, that happened several times, that he fumbled his answer to lots of questions. He was remarkably inarticulate. When I observed him as a senator, when I worked on Capitol Hill, and he was in the Senate, he was a quick-witted, fast-talking politician. The press loved him because he always had something interesting to say. My guess is that he's following his handler's advice to try to say nothing. The only problem is he's not good at saying nothing. He was mumbling his way through a lot of this. Some politicians are quite smart at saying nothing, and they make you walk away thinking, boy, that was an impressive statement he gave me. Then when you pick it apart, you realize he said nothing. He's not good at that. And I'm sure he's on his way back now to the White House, and they're going to have a huddle about how they're going to fix the problem here of his very disappointing performance in these hearings to make sure he's not going to lose Democratic votes as well. They'll have to impose some party discipline to make sure that they've got a solid flank of Democratic senators to support his nomination.
But he needs a few Republican votes as well, not so much to get out of the committee, but in the full Senate vote.
Well, only if they try to filibuster. They certainly have that right. That's wrapped up in some other internal Senate politics. The Republicans are probably feeling pretty emboldened about attacking him now, so I won't be surprised if they change their tactic. They were previously not threatening to filibuster him. But I won't be at all surprised if they now say, well, you're going to need 60 votes to break a filibuster against him.
Well, I thought one of the more depressing walkbacks on the part of Senator Hagel in questions from Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who was tearing into Hagel's global zero advocacy to get rid of nuclear weapons, which, after all, was put forth by people like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz. Why do you think he backed down on that?
I can't explain it. He did get out that he shared the view that Ronald Reagan expressed in his second inaugural address of limiting nuclear weapons. The organization that I used to work for, the Center for Defense Information at the World Security Institute, is the sponsor of Global Zero, so I should get that out on the table there. But he couldn't even adopt the position of defending his own views in the sense that we have this objective out there and we seek to get there. Instead, he tried to pretend he wasn't really sure what was in that report, and no, he didn't really support anything in it. And yet again, he was undoing things that he had associated himself with in the past. Raises the question, just what does he stand for? I mean, if he's the kind of person, the kind of politician who, when you're put under some kind of pressure to abandon your position, he will readily do so, that raises other questions about him. And I'm sure they're worried about his nomination in the White House today.
So is this a tactic? What is behind the fact that so many of his former colleagues in the Republican caucus of the United States Senate are now making such an effort to get rid of them? I know, as I mentioned earlier, McCain and Lindsey Graham seem to be motivated by a kind of bitterness towards, at least in McCain's case, a personal grudge that he lost to Obama. I don't understand why Graham has so many hissy fits all the time and why he is always going after them. Just the other day he said that Hillary Clinton got away with murder over Benghazi. He's definitely acting like their hitman. What do you understand, having served for these Republican senators? Is it just usual partisanship, or there is some deeper meaning here?
Well, you know, I can't explain politicians' personal behavior. What I do know is that Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, for example, is facing a Tea Party challenge in his 2014 election, so he's trying to appease that faction of his party to get through that. It's typical politicians' reactions or behavior. John McCain has a record to defend. He seems to demand that people accept his dogma that the surge in Iraq was a glorious happening and saved the war in Iraq, saved America from the ignominy in Iraq. It certainly didn't. And he was almost literally pounding the table, insisting that Senator Hagel agree with him. And Senator Hagel, to his own disgrace, refused to explain his criticism of the surge or that he had any big problem with it today. You know, it was politicians being politicians on both sides.
So is this a tactic, though, just to, with all of the ads against Hagel from right-wing pro-Israel groups and from the neoconservatives who really hate him because he's actually somebody who actually fought in the military as opposed to all of those chicken hawks like Bill Kristol and company. But already they've moved the goalpost way to the right just by attacking him and by these questions today and his need to sort of come out to out-hawk the hawks. He's laying down a very hawkish foreign policy. So to that extent, they've already succeeded, haven't they?
Well, there's a lot of money out there rattling through the system, requiring people to adopt these positions on questions like Iran and Israel's policy towards the Palestinians and so on. And I would surmise that that's a lot of explanation for what's going on here. There's a lot of anxiousness on the part of Republicans to solidify their base, just like Lindsey Graham solidifying his base for his primary challenge that he has won in 2014. It's politicians being politicians. And Chuck Hagel, because he showed weakness early on in the hearing, these guys really went after him. And the more they pushed, the more he caved. And so they kept on pushing.
And you think that he's going to have a problem getting the votes?
Well, I'm sure they're huddling in the White House right now, discussing what they need to do to preserve this nomination. They'll get the word out to the Democrats in the Senate that this is going to be a partisan issue, and they all have to rally behind Hagel. The Republicans are probably saying the same and trying to insist that even the senator who already said he might vote for Hagel's, Thad Cochran from Mississippi, that he change his position and now rally to the Republican side, and we're going to have a big fight. And it's going to be a foreign policy version of the budget debate where each side is basically saying, screw you.
So the Democrats, though, assuming they don't waver and that the White House gives them enough backbone, they've got the 14 votes on the committee. They need a majority out of 26, so they've already got a majority to get it out of committee. And then the real fight's going to happen in the full Senate.
Yeah, we'll see a party line catfight here, and we'll see all the disgusting behavior we've seen for the last several years on Capitol Hill.
And then an even bigger catfight.
Right, and we'll get noisy and the politicians will see as an opportunity to posture and to collect donations or the ability to get donations in the future. And so, you know, the Hagel nomination, it certainly looks to me, is going to become another football in the partisan fighting on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, but you're also implying, Winslow Wheeler, that it's also going to be a great fundraising tool for pro-Pentagon senators in the pocket of the military contractors to open the coffers?
For both sides. Both sides will be happy to do that. But in this case, it's going to be the Israel lobby and its benefactors like Sheldon Adelson who are going to be throwing around a lot of money trying to exercise their influence and probably doing it fairly successfully. But the manufacturers will be happy to be on both sides of this debate, and the Democrats will be just as happy to appease the manufacturers as the Republicans.
So he could go down, Hagel?
It depends on the end game, whether the Republicans push it to a 60-vote threshold or permit the debate to be decided by a majority vote. I would certainly guess that they're going to push it to a 60-vote threshold, and so the Democrats are going to need some Republicans if it gets to that. It's going to be tough.
Well, Winslow Wheeler, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And I was just speaking then with Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for over 30 years for members of the United States Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, he authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Project on Government Oversight and is the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll come back and discuss how successful gerrymandering by Republicans will backfire.
Every crack, anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan style.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeremiah Gooker, who writes about American politics and culture. His current work is focused on security, race, and the Republican Party, of which he is a former member. His recent work has been featured in Salon, The American Prospect, Tom Dispatch, and The Huffington Post, and he has an article at truthout.org, Shot by Their Own Men, How the Virginia Senate Inadvertently Predicts Republican Decline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremiah Gooker.
Thanks for having me again, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And a lot of what's being said now by people like John McCain, for example, in addressing the immigration issue is that the Republican Party is losing the support of minorities, particularly Hispanics and Latinos, and therefore, I don't know whether they see it as a public relations problem or they genuinely are capable of having a change of heart, but that seems to be the focus on their idea of fixing the demographic problem. But they're also going after essentially trying to rig the game and rig the playing field via the Electoral College. So I take it you think these two things are mutually exclusive in a way.
Yeah, in a way. The basic issue is that if the Republicans really, truly believe that they were going to be able to win enough Hispanic votes to simply win in a normal Democratic approach, then maybe we would see them actively shutting up the xenophobic part of the party and actually pushing to get Hispanics the vote, particularly ones who aren't citizens yet, to get them the vote sooner rather than later, to do less voter suppression type policies and try to actually get Hispanics out voting. Now, that fact that they're not doing that suggests that they know that they've got a long way to go in terms of getting significant Hispanic votes, even just in a slicing and dicing approach to maybe just grab a few here and there to win some narrow elections. of course, if they go to this approach of trying to wiggle with the Electoral College, that's just basically a showing that they know that they can't win in on a statewide Democratic front. And, well, they want to rig the system so they can win. And, you know, the initial talk that we've seen in several states, and we saw the head of the RNC, Republican National Commission, suggest that this is maybe a good idea, would be to change voting rules within states. And, of course, states have control of their electoral process. But instead of having the Electoral College vote go to who wins overall within a state, to dole out the votes on a basis of congressional districts, whoever wins which congressional district would go. And in states where they've already been able to gerrymander the seats in a way that advantages Republicans, when you look at the numbers that way, it would lead to many more electoral votes going to Republicans, as Romney actually would have won the election in the Electoral College that way, even though he still would have lost the public vote by 5 million votes.
In your article at truthout.com, Jeremiah Gorka, shot by their own men, how the Virginia Senate inadvertently predicts Republican decline, you point out that on the very day of the inauguration, when President Obama was speaking about Selma, Seneca Falls, and Stonewall, the Republican Senate in Virginia was proposing to honor another Stonewall, in this case Stonewall Jackson. And that was, of course, the day that they slipped through while a key Democrat was attending the inaugural. And, of course, the inaugural happened on Martin Luther King's birthday, and this key Democrat was a well-known civil rights leader. He was at the inauguration and the MLK celebrations, and while they were talking about celebrating a Confederate slave owner, they also slipped through this attempt at gerrymandering and changing the Electoral College, which now they've had to retreat from. So explain to us what this pushback is and where it's coming from. And I'm somewhat surprised, frankly, that you can shame people who appear to be shameless.
Right. Well, there's two separate parts of this. One is changing congressional districts and state-level legislative districts. And then there's the aspect of changing how the Electoral College goes. And so from my last look at this, the redistricting within Virginia is still moving forward, but Virginia has backed off of the idea of changing the Electoral College. And it does look like this has gotten enough notice nationally that the governors in Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania, where there's been talk of pushing this change for Electoral College, are backing off. And the Virginia bill to change Electoral College within Virginia that bill passed a subcommittee but got struck down in committee. So it is interesting that there have been enough Republicans who've seen that this is going to blow up in their face. And, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe they're realizing that in the long term, if they were actually successful in changing the Electoral College on a state level basis like this, next in 2016, and a Republican wins after being crushed by the popular vote, that's a pretty good way to actually lead to a national-level movement to simply abolish the Electoral College entirely and lead to an actual Democratic approach to presidential elections in this country. And Republicans may think that they're better off with the Electoral College than they are with full actual democracy. I mean, as you'll often hear Republicans say, it's a republic and not a democracy. And, you know, I was talking to somebody at one of the right-wing think tanks who said that America, what they really wanted in 2012 was not Obama. And I asked, well, is that true? I mean, how many people voted? What if we really got everyone out to vote? Do you think that they really wanted Romney? And his response was, well, I don't think anyone really wants everyone to come out and vote.
Well, that has been characteristic of American politics. You have one party, the Democrats, who have a natural majority but fail to inspire enough of those people to vote often. And when they do, they win. And on the other hand, you got a minority party that depends upon Democrats voting for them, and they are able to get every one of their people out to vote on a regular basis, but their numbers are declining because of the changing demographics. So that's their challenge. So now they're resorting to how they can cheat. But the genesis for so much of their success, electorally and particularly in the control of the House, goes back to 2010, doesn't it? And that's the difference that I see, is that the Republicans have got strategic thinkers like Karl Rove, who saw the opportunity to capture the governorships and legislatures in all of these key swing states and went ahead and did it.
Yep, that's true. And then they were successful at it. And since you have every 10 years the census where there's a moment for reapportionment of seats, whoever is in control of a state legislature gets to make those changes. And yeah, it's been working for the Republicans in a, at least in the short-term way. And when, as I say in my article, I think that in the long term it's going to shoot them in the foot, because when you create really safe seats, it creates a single-party politics dynamic where the incumbent, rather than having to fight off someone in the other party and therefore play somewhat moderate politics, instead has to fight off extremist party primary challengers from within his or her own party, causing that incumbent to prostrate themselves to the extremes within their own party. And they have legitimate reasons to fear being, quote-unquote, primaried, as we saw Senator Lugar get knocked out in the otherwise safe state of Indiana in this last cycle. So as long as that happens, there will always be lots of local candidates who will say really crazy things, basically, in order to placate the extremists within their own party. And at, you know, in the age of the internet, word gets out fast, and so that's where you have Aiken, Todd Aiken, and Richard Murdoch, crazy statements about rape, you know, babies being a gift from God, and legitimate rape. That stuff spreads like wildfire, and so it doesn't take that many kind of crazy candidates or incumbents prostrating themselves to the right, or particularly different areas of the extreme right, to likely really push away a lot of swing voters on a national level.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about American politics and culture. His current work is focused on security, race, and the Republican Party, of which he is a former member. His recent work has been featured in Salon, The American Prospect, Tom Dispatch, and The Huffington Post. And he has an article at truthout.org, Shot by Their Own Men, How the Virginia Senate Inadvertently Predicts Republican Decline. But just back to the short term as opposed to the long term, the argument that you made, that because they'll have to pander to the right because of this gerrymandering, the Republicans will only have extremists, and those that the incumbents will have to go to the extremes in order to neutralize extremists running against them on the far right. And that's going to turn off a lot of people. Going back to their successes in 2010, the strategy largely developed by Karl Rove and funded by the American Petroleum Institute, where they took these state legislatures in these key swing states. And that was, of course, a census, so that's locked in for 10 years. So it looks as if for at least the next 8 years, the Democrats are going to have a hard time taking back the House, aren't they?
Yeah, probably. They'll have to do a really sort of stellar job politically to get the House back. And, I think it's probably unlikely, especially considering how in off years there just isn't much turnout. And the turnout that does show up tends to be within demographics that favor Republicans.
So what should their strategy be then? I mean, if already the playing field is rigged against them. What are they going to do? I mean, can you make an argument about democracy in this democracy? Can you appeal to the American people's notion of patriotism that this is simply outrageous to manipulate the very mechanics of democracy?
There are probably a couple of things they can try to do. I mean, one is what Democrats might think are against their own interests, since Democrats do some gerrymandering, not as much as the Republicans, but they've still been guilty of it some, would be to basically say that the party is now opposed to gerrymandering and wants to figure out some kind of impartial redistricting approach, maybe try to find some sort of best practice that and build on the experience of the like California-type committees that approach redistricting very differently than in the political gerrymandering approach. And then you hear some rumors about how the Democrats are out trying to encourage crazies to run in primaries against incumbents and in places where if a crazy is able to primary the incumbent, then maybe there'll be enough Democrats in the district to win in a general election.
But it would seem to me that even if that there's a possibility that that is true, people like Murdoch and Todd Aitken, they're their own people. They're talking from their own hearts and minds, if assuming they have them. There's no way in the world you need to manipulate those people.
No, that's true. You don't need to encourage them, though maybe a little cash their way would help.
So tell me then about We discussed earlier about what seems to have stopped them, and I'm still not quite sure about, has it been the media attention that's taken the steam out of this kind of stealth attempt to rig the Electoral College? I just would be suspicious that it's over now. If I were a Democrat, I wouldn't be declaring victory.
Right. So, is it a response to the media? I mean, very possibly. Politicians are extremely reactive as opposed to proactive, and so if they think something's gone dangerous for them, they'll get squeamish and walk away. So it very likely is the fact that this made national news when probably at the state level they were hoping that it wouldn't, particularly considering that the news desks in state capitals have shrunk so much over time with media mergers and cutting reporting desks all around. I think a lot of folks in state legislatures have been kind of used to being able to do stuff without getting noticed. So the fact that they got, particularly the Virginia story, went national may have made a lot of the politicians skittish. But is this victory? Yeah, I can imagine very easily that this is only temporary, and as with something like the Keystone XL pipeline, that the people who want it will just stop for a little bit and gather their thoughts and their powers and try again later on.
So, Jeremiah Gorka, then, is there a connection then between this new Republican Party that inherited all of the Democratic Party's Dixiecrats with the Nixon Southern strategy and have largely become a Southern party? And obviously, the South, the Confederacy, has a history of voter suppression with the Jim Crow, to put it mildly. And of course, there's a very important Supreme Court case now whether to overturn Article 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which means that the Justice Department has to pre-clear these Southern ex-Confederate states over voting and electoral issues. That's being challenged at the Supreme Court, and who knows how that's going to go. So give me a sense of how much the Republican Party is a Southern party and whether they simply can't help themselves because racism is in their DNA.
Well, that's one of the things that a lot of Republicans always deny, is the extent to which racism is in the DNA of the Republican Party. But it absolutely is in the overt ways that we saw with, as you mentioned, the Southern strategy, as well as plenty of covert ways and subconscious ways, considering that so much of what Republicans stand for is the opposition to any form of social safety net based on the notion of people getting it are indolent. And in the mental image of people talking about indolence, they usually have an image of a black person. And it pervades the party from the start of its modern growth since, say, Goldwater being the first Republican in years to get only single digits of black voters, percentage of black voters, and that's happened every year since. I think the Republicans cannot get away from their issues of race, particularly now that they so clearly see themselves as being the party of white people. They assume that minorities are always going to vote for Democrats. Democratic Party they see as being basically a party of color and the enemy, so they're always finding ways to basically get the most out of the power of the white vote. And yeah, the Republican Party has been very keen on getting rid of the Voting Rights Act. Every time it reappears up for renewal, they want to kill it.
Well, they have a majority on the Supreme Court, and they may be successful very soon. But when you said earlier that you talked to somebody in a right-wing think tank and they basically don't consider President Obama a legitimate president, even though he's won two elections very, very soundly and got reelected with a 5 million vote advantage over Romney, there's still this idea that he's not legitimate. So where does that idea come from, that somehow these people that vote in this makers versus takers idea, these people who vote are the takers, and that the Democratic Party is not really qualified to represent America because it's only basically a party that bribes the underclass to get into power? I believe that is their mindset. I mean, elaborate on that, if you will.
No, that absolutely is the mindset that many, since most Republicans are white, you can stereotype and say that white Republicans think that the Democratic Party succeeds purely by giving gifts, in Romney's words, to minorities in order to bribe them for votes. And of course, Republicans will absolutely deny when the inverse, to say that they're trying to bribe white voters with lower taxes, because they would say, oh, that's not a bribe because that was my money already that the government was trying to steal. So they don't think that that's true. You know, to some extent, maybe to be as imaginatively charitable as I can on this one, I think that a lot of Republicans feel like President Obama truly does not represent them, because by him being a black man and black equating with a Democratic Party of color, they feel like it's very much not a party with any interest in them. I think they feel like they're not being represented at all, because they've created this wall that Democrats equal race equal not us. And then hence you get all these words of, you know, Romney's bumper sticker, you know, what was it, Taking Back America. You know, they want their America, and they think that the, you know, America of cities is minorities and Jews and people not like them. It can be awfully simplistic this way, and I think people feel it on a kind of an emotional level that they just don't connect with. And of course, you know, Republican Party politics tries to encourage it and say it's Heartland versus the ghettos and the Upper East Side.
Well, just in closing, Jeremiah Gorka, back to your article, Truth Out, Shot by Their Own Men, How the Virginia Senate Inadvertently Predicts Republican Decline. The point here is that this gerrymandering that's going to give them a short-term advantage and it's going to make them hold the House for at least the next 8 years, unless something miraculous happens and the Democrats catch on fire in 2014, the outcome then is what? That they will continue to be a minority party, and the more they gerrymander, the more extreme their representatives will be, and the more they'll turn off the growing majority. Is that the dynamic?
Yeah, I think that is the dynamic. I think that they're looking at having real challenges at statewide elections in states where they have a lot of gerrymandered districts. And I think they're going to have a really hard time on the presidential level, particularly starting in, say, 2020 and beyond, when they have actual incumbents and actual party candidates saying crazy and hateful things that will just drive too many people away. And in a slicing and dicing world, when you're not talking about always winning by 5 million votes, but often on a very close level, losing relatively small number of votes even through enabling crazy candidates through these single-party districts, I think is going to shoot them in the foot in the long term.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeremiah Gorka.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And I was just speaking then with Jeremiah Gorka, who writes about American politics and culture. His current work is focused on security, race, and the Republican Party, of which he is a former member. His recent work has been featured in Salon, The American Prospect, Tom Dispatch, and The Huffington Post. And he has an article at truthout.org, Shot by Their Own Men, How the Virginia Senate Inadvertently Predicts Republican Decline. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how Chinese hackers attacked the New York Times.
Hustling around Atlanta in the alligator suit, getting drunk every weekend at the barbecue, and keeping the niggas down. We're rednecks, we're rednecks. We don't know our ass from a hole in the ground. We're rednecks, we're rednecks. We're keeping the niggas down.
Protect your eyes, protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gordon Chang, who is the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He is a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who is a columnist at Forbes and blogs at World Affairs Journal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Chang.
Thank you so much.
And clearly, the New York Times has been hacked, and I don't think there's much mystery as to who did it, Chinese hackers. And it appears to be fairly clear that it was in response to stories that they ran about Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabai's how he'd accumulated this multi-billion dollar fortune, at least his family had. Now, apparently, that story was blocked, both in English and Chinese language versions of the paper's website. But what we're learning now from today's New York Times is that they hacked into the New York Times while this story was being prepared, presumably looking to find the sources of the story. So that would indicate to me that these are probably intelligence people as opposed to hackers.
Yes. Well, the New York Times story mentions that these attacks have been traced to an organization in China which has been responsible for cyber intrusions on hundreds of Western organizations, including American defense contractors. So, as you say, there's no mystery about why and who and about all the circumstances regarding this cyber intrusions.
So is this the same organization that put that sleeper inside a lot of government computers, and including the Department of Energy, and where they're able to apparently get the designs for all of the latest U.S. nuclear warheads and God knows what else?
Yes, and clearly what we've got here is a situation where the Chinese government has this systematic campaign to find information, not only from government sources, but defense contractors, dissidents, and now news organizations, because it's not just the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal reported that its computers have been hacked by China as well. So this appears to be an epidemic.
Well, Gordon Cheng, apparently on Thursday, the Wall Street Journal revealed that they'd been hacked, and the Bloomberg News were hacked apparently following a June 29th article that detailed wealth accumulated by the family of Xi Jinping, who is the country's new leader.
Yes, and clearly what's going on here is that this is, people say, well, the Communist Party is a threat to its own people. Well, that's certainly right. But it's also a threat to ours because they're attacking free institutions and free societies by trying to affect the political discourse inside the United States. So this really has become a problem not just for China, but for us as well.
Well, it would seem, and again, Gordon Cheng is the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World and the Coming Collapse of China. He's a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who has a columnist at Forbes and blogs at World Affairs Journal. It would seem, though, that China's main focus is on its own people, and the leadership is clearly looking over its shoulder at its own people who somehow or other seem to be able to get this news in spite of the fact that China is being ranked by the Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index as 173 out of 179 countries in the world. So it's a heavily censored media there. I'm not sure that their efforts to influence our media, I've seen that they've taken out full-page ads in the New York Times, et cetera, about economic opportunities and stuff like that. But I don't think they're going to have much traction here, but they surely do at home. And what surprises me is the extent to which apparently the Chinese people find out about these things. By the way, today CNN was blacked out in reporting on this New York Times story.
Yes. Well, I think what's going on here is that the Chinese government has tried to control the narrative about China around the world. And one of the ways to do that is, first of all, to find out what international news media organizations are saying, but also to try to intimidate reporters. And to a certain extent, they've been successful because they have affected coverage of China. Now, I think that that's sort of, those days are over because clearly we've reached a tipping point. But, China is going to continue to try. And because of that, we do have to be vigilant about these things.
Well, I think the clear tactic that they've been using, and particularly with the New York Times and other American news organizations, is that they hold up visas. And it's very hard for these news organizations to get their people in there and get them accredited. That seems to be the latest tactic.
Yes, well, they've also used that against academics. And this is a tactic that has actually worked, because I do think that academics self-censor themselves in order to make sure that they do get visas. Because if they don't get visas, then they can't continue their work. So this is a tactic that has worked against academics, and they're now using it against journalists as well. This is something that they've done for quite some time, so we really shouldn't be too surprised that they try to use all instruments of state power against the media.
Well, they've successfully blacklisted Perry Link, who I often speak with, who's a China expert from Princeton, to whom the Tiananmen papers were leaked from a high-level Politburo source. So, you know, the fact that so much of the dirty laundering of the Politburo itself came out in the Bozhi Lai case, and clearly there were sources, which is why the hackers were hacking into the New York Times before they printed that story in October of last year about the fabulous wealth of the Chinese leaders. The fact that they have sources would indicate to me that things are changing inside. And again, I get back to trying to get a handle from you, Gordon Chang, about the apparent insecurity of communist Chinese leaders about their capitalist riches.
Yeah, well, certainly they've got to be very concerned about it because, you know, especially with regard to Premier Wen Jiabao, he was the acceptable face of communism. He was the top leader who cried at the scenes of natural disasters, who visited the downtrodden, who called for democracy. And now we learned that he's no different than the other Chinese leaders. You know, he's just a crook like the rest of them. And so I think that they are really very sensitive about it. And, of course, they would be sensitive about the Bloomberg reporting on the family of Xi Jinping, because right now he is the leader of China, as you point out. So, you know, people can't say that corruption is limited only to the bottom part of the Communist Party. With all of this reporting, it's clear that it also affects the top of the party, and the amount that these leaders have been able to take one way or another is just fabulous. It's just in the billions and billions of dollars.
So what's happening then inside of China in terms of you know, they're clearly probably the most, I imagine they're about the most sophisticated country in the world in terms of trying to control the internet. But ultimately, yes, the good news about the internet is it is uncontrollable. Maybe, you know, I'm not sure whether it is, but my sense is that people always find ways around information, and the fact that the Chinese censors block out these stories like in the New York Times and CNN, and yet the Chinese people find out about it. And how do they do that? Well, it has to be that through the internet. And one of the things I was just noticing recently was that a bunch of internet activists in China brought down a Chinese Communist Party censor who was a complete hypocrite and had been paying off some woman for sex who was an employee of his. So,
yes, well, you know, you're absolutely right, because although, as you say, China has the most sophisticated set of internet controls, clearly has one of the largest, probably the largest group of censors, full stop, they have not been able to really control information like they were able to during the Maoist years. And that's because China's a more open society. People do learn about these things. You know, they can censor the New York Times and Bloomberg websites, but enough people find out. And so really what we have got is a situation where the Communist Party is concerned about the narrative inside China, and the party no longer controls it. I think the Chinese people are very much taking their destiny into their own hands.
And so give us a sense then of how the leadership is riding this tiger.
Well, they're riding it, and I think that the one sense is that they can no longer control the narrative in Chinese society. What they can do is they can prevent people from acting on their beliefs. When you look around Chinese society from the top to the bottom, I actually think that most people do not believe that a one-party system is appropriate for China's modernizing society. That doesn't mean that people are going to take to the streets to try to change that political system, but it does mean that the Communist Party can no longer influence thought what it can do is it could prevent people from going to the streets and trying to change the political system from the bottom up.
But that's only a temporary barrier, is it not? I mean, you've got people like Ai Weiwei. They come after prominent people, and I don't know whether you saw the very inspiring film about him and how he, fought the system. And obviously, the system came down hard on him. But there are thousands and thousands of Ai Weiweis every day, aren't there, in small ways that are resisting?
Yes, that's certainly true. But, you talk about Ai Weiwei himself. You know, he's still in Beijing. He is still affecting political discourse, not only in the capital city, but around China. You know, he had that, for instance, that very famous photograph he had taken of himself in a gas mask because he was complaining about the smog in Beijing. Well, that photograph got distributed around China and around the world, and it does change people's views of the regime. And as you say, it's not just Ai Weiwei, but there are thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of Ai Weiweis basically doing the same thing, perhaps on a smaller basis, but also reaching a number of people around China. And that's how society is changing. And it's changing much for the better because Chinese people are having these conversations among themselves about a number of important topics.
Again, I'm speaking with Gordon Chang, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World and the Coming Collapse of China. He's a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who is a columnist at Forbes and blogs at World Affairs Journal. So what's happening then vis-a-vis the divisions within the Chinese Communist Party leadership? And it seems in many ways that what's this nuclear test that's coming up in North Korea might well expose those divisions. And I know you wrote that book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. My understanding is that the support for the North Korean regime, even though many in the top leadership in China are exasperated by the dynasty ruling North Korea, but the support is largely in the military. And yet, the foreign ministry types are furious with the North Koreans. And they joined recently in UN Security Council sanctions against them over a rocket launch. So you can only imagine that when this bomb goes off, they're going to have to, they're going to be even stiffer sanctions. And do you think the struggle between the pro-North Korean and the anti-North Korean factions inside China are going to come to the fore?
Well, I think that they probably will. The one thing about Chinese foreign policy in general is that you need a consensus to change it. And right now, as you point out, there are a lot of foreign ministry professionals, there are academics, there are people in the think tank community in Beijing who realize that China's policies with regard to North Korea are really not in the country's long-term interest. But there is no consensus to change the policy because there are a number of hardliners, many of them in the military, who want to keep the policy the same. So, although there is some movement in Beijing on North Korea, there isn't as much as there should be. And when we see this third nuclear detonation on the part of by North Korea, it'll be very interesting to watch if China substantially changes its policies. I think that there will be some change, but not enough.
Well, how about a change on the American side in the sense that the justification for Chinese hawks in supporting North Korea, even though it's a very obnoxious failed state, and they're already feeling and the Chinese basically could pull the plug on them in a minute. But they don't, my understanding is they don't want American troops on the Yellow River. They don't want to go back to the Korean War. And that's a legitimate concern on their part.
I think that if the North Korean regime were to collapse soon, that there probably would be an understanding that American troops would not be on the Yalu River. And there really wouldn't be a need for that because American troops, there's about 28,500 of them in South Korea right now, are there to protect the South Koreans from the North Koreans. If the North Korean state fails, then I think that you're going to find a very substantial reduction in American forces in South Korea. just because we will not need them there. And so I don't think the issue is going to be that a big one. It's one that can easily be solved between Washington and Beijing.
So, Gordon Chang, just then back to the story of the day, which is the hacking of the New York Times. The New York Times ran a front-page story explaining how they've been hacked by Chinese hackers, presumably at the behest of the government, if not this organization that you mentioned. Tell us more about this organization, because it would seem to be obviously a part of the military intelligence apparatus, because they targeted, for example, Los Alamos over, I mean, the DOE's labs over here. They've gone after defense contractors to get the latest technology, etc. So that it seems to be strategic, it seems to be planned. And in this case, going after the New York Times, trying to find out who was leaking information about the fabulous riches of Chinese leaders, it's clear that the top people in China were instigating the witch hunt.
Well, clearly they were. There are a number of shadowy groups in China that do the hacking. I mean, there's some that are actually part of the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army. There are some that are actually part of the country's security services, the Ministry of State Security, for instance. And then you have these networks that are loosely affiliated with the Chinese government. And we don't really know too much about the group that conducted the hacking, except that the Times did say that they had been involved in cyber intrusions of hundreds of organizations around the world, including American defense contractors. That would suggest that they do have close connections with the Chinese military, if maybe they're part of the military itself. But at the end of the day, all of these groups operate with the blessing of the Chinese government. And so, in a sense, it almost doesn't matter which particular department of the government is actually conducting this. This really is part of Beijing's master plan.
Well, so far, the Chinese hackers have not just gone after the New York Times. They've gone after Lockheed Martin, Coca-Cola, Google. I'm talking about hacking into. There was this ghost net that came up in Canada, hacking into information about the Dalai Lama and Tibetan activists. NASA has been hacked into 47 times, apparently, in 2011 alone, and JPL as well as Caltech. South Korea has been hacked into. The Pentagon, of course, the 2007 intrusion with that sleeper bug that apparently downloaded an enormous amount of stuff. And then now you've got the New York Times. So there's quite a list.
Yeah, it's quite a list. And, you know, if you're not on the list, yeah, you're nobody. So.
Right. Well, I'm afraid I'm just getting a signal here that I've run out of time. Thank you for joining us, Gordon Chang.
Well, thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gordon Chang, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He's a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who is a columnist at Forbes and blogs at World Affairs Journal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.